You're listening to the Belly Dance Geek Clubhouse at bellydancegeek.com. All right. Hello, everybody. This is Nadira Jamal, and welcome to episode 41 of the Belly Dance Geek Clubhouse. If you'd like to sponsor the Clubhouse, we do have opportunities for advertising here on the call. If you're interested, you can email me at nadira@nadirajamal.com. The Clubhouse is a place where dancers can get together and geek out on all of those things that are hard to get in classes and on DVDs. If you want help with the what, things like moves and combinations and choreographies, there are a lot of resources out there for you. But if you're more interested in the why and the how, so things like musicality, composition, business, culture, ethics, these things can be a little bit harder to find. So every month I interview a different guest expert on a different geeky topic, and we always have time for question and answer so you can geek out too. So if you think that knowledge and creativity go together like chocolate and peanut butter, you are in the right place. My guest tonight is Sausen. She's been studying ethnic dance since she was 3 years old, with Egyptian-style belly dance as her main interest. She owns the Al Mosri Egyptian Restaurant, where she showcases her graduates from the Sausen Academy of Egyptian Dance, and provides live Egyptian music to dancers in the San Francisco Bay Area. She's discovered the specific cultural facet to making Egyptian dance look authentic and has registered it as the Egyptian Dance Code. You can check her out at sausenacademy.com, which is spelled SAUCADEMY.com, and I hope you'll check her out. So welcome, Sausen.
Well, thank you very much. I'm so excited to be here. This is just an honor.
I'm so excited to have you. So for folks who haven't heard this story, Sausen and I met at the Las Vegas Belly Dance Intensive. I think we had run into each other occasionally online, and we sat together on the bus to one of the shows, and I didn't realize who she was until I'd been speaking for 10 minutes, so I knew I had to have her on the show.
Thank you. That's correct.
So Sausen, why don't you tell us about how you got started in Oriental dance?
Well, it was when I was a little kid. I was going through my dad's LP collection, and I discovered that he had a couple of LPs with some scantily clad belly dancers on the front covers. And later I discovered that it was those two, Neza Ates and Babuka. And I was always really, really intrigued. And I had taken ethnic dance when I was a kid. I had taken Thai classical dancing and then flamenco, and I even performed for Queen Sirikit when I was about 10 years old in Thailand. And so when I moved out of the house and went to Sacramento, I just decided to start looking around for a belly dance teacher, and I didn't really think much about it, but I opened up the yellow pages of our telephone book. And there was Jodette, and I thought, oh my gosh, I'm going to take a belly dance class. And I went down there and I registered, and the rest is history. It all came from those two LPs that my dad had in his record collection.
Mm-hmm. It's amazing how often sometimes just a little thing sets us on the path that turns into our entire lives.
That's correct. It was, and that's what happened. And I'm so blessed that I actually came across those two records, because Jodette really did change my life.
Mm-hmm. And can you tell us a little bit about how you got into the restaurant business as well?
Oh, of course. Well, I was in Sacramento for 3 years with Jodette, and moved to San Francisco. And of course, I started working in all the nightclubs out here when we had them. There aren't that many anymore here in San Francisco, but I ventured into a place called the Grape Leaf, and I had, watched a lot of the cooks cook meals, and of course, Jodette introduced me to hummus and baba ganoush and a lot of other really great dishes. And so when I started dancing here at the Grape Leaf, I started learning how to do the cuisine here of Lebanon. And then about a year and a half later, I married the owner, Gabe Michael, and so he taught me how to cook all the cuisine and the food, and then I just learned the belly dance. I mean, I learned the restaurant business and how to run the floor and how to, we had a bar at that time. I learned how to make drinks and then learned how to become a waitress. You know, I'm actually a secretary. I type 90 words a minute, and I used to take shorthand at 140. So this is a whole brand new thing for me. So it was from the Postal Service that I quit my job and went full time after I married Gabe, and the rest is history. I just began doing a lot more with the restaurant and researching the dance. And you know, when you're in the restaurant, not only do you learn how to cook, but you're inundated with the music and the people that come through that are Lebanese or other Arabs or Jordanians and Egyptians, just the Arab population in general. And you pick up so much and you hear music so much. It's day in and day out that it was just incredible how much I learned in the time that I was here, working at the Grape Leaf restaurant.
Mm-hmm. And can you tell us the story of how you came upon the Egyptian dance code as well?
Oh, of course. When I started dancing, with Jodette. Jodette is half Egyptian, and she was born over there, and she was actually brought up with the gypsies. And I don't mean that in a bad way, saying that she was brought up with gypsies, but she was brought up with those people who celebrated life every single night, and they got out and they danced, and this is where she learned to dance. And so when she came to the United States, she found a niche and she started teaching belly dancing. But the thing about Jodette is that she was teaching us, although she was teaching us with the follow me method, she was teaching us through her own experience, her own cultural experience that she was brought up with. And so when I was watching her dancing, it was really exciting. It was amazing to see this person dancing. And that was back in 74. And then I moved to San Francisco in 1977 and wanted to continue my studies with the dance. And so I went to different teachers. And, there was something that was missing, there was something flat or something not the same as what Jodette was teaching. And then, one day I put a whole bunch of videotapes into my VCR and started watching the dancers of the Golden Age of Egypt. And some of them included Halel Safi, Nagwa Fouad, Soher Zaki, all of those, Mona Said. And there was still that something. I didn't quite know what that was. And I kept wondering what it was and wondering what it was. Well, long story short, 28 years later, and it did take me 28 years, and it does take a person a lifetime because that's about how long it takes a person to really learn a language without an accent. And I discovered that the Egyptians hear and keep the beat of the music totally different from how the Western hears and keeps the beat of the music. And when I discovered that, it was a revelation. It was like somebody had just hit me in the face. And so I developed a whole curriculum around it, and I called it the Egyptian Dance Code. So the way they hear, would you like me to go on about how they do that?
Please. Why don't you start by giving us a quick overview of what some of the basic principles are, and then we'll dig into each of them.
Okay. Well, the thing about the Egyptian Dance Code is that the basic principle is that the Egyptians, when you hear a measure of four beats, one, two, three, four, one, two, three, four, in the West, we tend to keep the beat going down on beats one and three so that our chest drops on beats one and three, and we snap our fingers down toward the ground, keeping the beat, and we tap the front of our foot so that we have our beats one and three going down, and two and four, we kind of lift the chest. Well, in Egypt, it's not that way. They do it completely the opposite way. They lift their chest on beats one and three, tap with the heel of their foot, and then drop on beats two and four. And this is true of not just the Egyptian dancing, but also any Arab country that's doing the dance. It's the way the Arabs hear and keep the beat of the music. Does that explain it okay?
Well, that's certainly a great place to start. So when you talk about snapping downwards, so you're thinking if I was just counting one, two, three, four.
Uh-huh.
You just mean the general tendency of people to drop their hands while they're doing that counting, is that right?
Yes. Okay, so if you have a measure of four counts, like, okay, for instance, the drums go doom, doom, tek-a-tek, doom, tek-a-tek, one and two and three and one, two, three, four, five, six, seven, eight is the beat is kept. Mm-hmm. If you're doing that and you're doing it full time, and I know this sounds really kind of strange, the beat on one and three, and then continuing on the odd beats, are lifted on the chest so that, okay, so for instance, if you go into a club that is frequented by Arabs, do you ever see an Arab clapping their hands up in the air? And when they snap Yes. their fingers, they put their two hands together and they snap in the air. Is that right?
Yep, I've seen that.
Yeah, and that's because the Egyptians, or all Arabs, or most Arabs, clapped the beat of the music up on beats one and three. And this is why it looks so strange to us when they're clapping their hands. They're clapping their hands up on one, coming down on two, clapping their hands on three, and coming down on four. Whereas we clap our hands down on one, bring our chest up, and down on three, and bring our chest up. We also snap our fingers on one, two, three, four, down. And the Arabs snap their fingers using their both hands on going up on one, down on two, up on three, down on four. Is that a little clearer?
Yes. I think what I was misunderstanding was you were thinking, when you were saying chest up, I was imagining like an actual chest lift belly dance movement. But I think it sounds like you're saying just kind of general grooving out when you're trying to feel the beat.
Exactly. Yes.
Gotcha.
That's right. And for the Egyptians, when you see this, it lifts the whole feel of the dance. It puts a whole different slant on the dance. And when I discovered this, it was a revelation to me. It was just mind-boggling that little minute, little trivial thing that is staring you right in the face could just change the whole dance.
Excellent. Well, let's dig into this a little bit. So, you know, one of the big things that this seems to have an effect on is, you know, how expression plays out in different contexts. Mm-hmm. So, you know, what are some of the differences between Western and Egyptian expression?
Okay. So, for instance, and I've seen this happen not only in circles of my Arab friends, but also in the movies. And we tend to not watch Arab movies or Egyptian movies too much, and there are a lot of them out there with Egyptian with the American subtitles or English subtitles. But if you see Arabs and they are expressing themselves, when they, for instance, hurt themselves, or if somebody has passed away in their family, the group of women are there and they're expressing their grief, and I'm gonna make an expression that's going to probably hurt your ears, but they lift their arms in the air and they go, aah! And they're wailing. When we here in the United States are grieving for someone, we're sitting down and we're very quiet. People walk in the room. Everything's really quiet. Nothing really gets said except for people will express condolences and they're sitting around. And there's not very much wailing really going on. There's a lot of crying, but there's not very much wailing. Now, another expression was the clapping, what I had said before, and the finger snapping. There's another thing with when they do the zaggarit. Of course, it resonates through their sinuses and it's supported in their diaphragm. And when they release the zaggarit, after they have the hand of their mouth, when they release the zaggarit, their hand flies away from the mouth as if they are throwing the zaggarit out into the audience or into the world. Whereas here, we usually say something like, yee-haw. And if you notice the yee-haw, it goes down to the ground. Let's see, there's another one. Arabs write from... And English people, English or American-speaking people, Westerners write from left to right. That's another difference. When someone approaches you who speaks Arabic, they will say, ahlan wa sahlan, ahlan wa sahlan. If you notice, the chest is always moving. It's very animated. So you'll hear this, ahlan wa sahlan. And when we greet somebody, we'll go, hey, yo, hey, what's happening? And we're always going down to the ground when we express ourselves, while the Arabs or the Egyptians lift their chest up as if to welcome the whole space or the sky around them rather than expressing themselves toward the ground. Is that a little bit clearer?
Yeah, that's really interesting. And do you have any suggestions for how to bring that quality into our dancing?
Well, you know, this is the problem of this. I mean, I can explain this, and I can even prove it to everybody by showing this happening in the dances where they're lifting the chest. But, you know, it's not in the American or the Western experience. It's just not in our experience to do this. And so when I start teaching a class, the first class, of course, is to teach the women in my class to lift their chests on beats 1 and 3 and drop them on 2 and 4 while tilting their pelvis back on 1 and 3 and then bringing it in on 2 and 4 for the upper body movements. And, you know, it takes them, a lot of them, about, I don't know, 1 or 2 whole classes to get that, because we're so ingrained dropping our chest on beats 1 and 3 when we're dancing. It's very ingrained in us as a Western society.
And, you know, you mentioned that it took you 28 years to figure out what was going on. You know, why do you think it is so hard for Westerners to see that detail?
Because it's not in our experience. We don't have that experience. We cannot see that we've never experienced. We can study it, and then eventually there's an aha moment, and then you get it, you know, kind of like Darwin when he was out, you know, in the ships, and then he realized that there was this whole evolution thing happening, and I think it took him 8 years to write his book because he was afraid he was going to be so rejected. But it's just not in our experience. When we walk down the street, we tend to, as women, protect our upper body, our chest. When we stand on one leg and we cross our arms in front of us. And when we talk, we use our hands more as an expression, of course, but we are always kind of protecting our bodies, where in the Middle East or in Egypt, I think they have their male counterparts that are out to do something to the families or the men of the families if they're being too friendly to their sisters or their mothers. And I, you know, that goes into a whole different subject, but it's very true. I mean, women over there, when they are dressed, they'll cover themselves up for the most part, but when they go into a party atmosphere or a situation, they're partying with other women and they're dancing with each other and they're showing off their finery and they're trying to outdo each other. And that's just not even, that part of it is not even in our experience. So it's these things that we have to really take note of how they're expressing themselves and how they are gathering and what they're doing to see how the dance is, how it's transferred into the dance. And it's just not in our experience. And, you know, in our experience, mostly it's ballet, jazz, tap. So we tend to put ballet, jazz, and tap into a lot of our dances so that we can make it, you know, look good for a huge audience, when in fact there is no ballet or jazz or tap in belly dancing.
Well, that seems to be a good segue into talking about some of the movement differences. So, coming to the dance after having spent that 28 years unlocking that understanding, what are some of the differences that you see in Egyptian versus Western movement?
Okay, well, there's something that I think was coined by a school called Maya hips. Maya hips are those reverse hip undulation thingies where you go out to the side and bring them in, down to the floor and then bring them in. I hope the listeners know what I'm talking about when I say Maya hips. And in the Egyptian style dancing, there is something that looks like Maya hips, but without the Egyptian dance code, without the lift of the rib cage, the Maya hips can be done, because Maya hips are in isolation. When you use the Egyptian dance code, Maya hips become something totally different. So in Egyptian dancing, I've also learned that there are no isolations. And I was happy to find out that in the last time I went to the Las Vegas intensive, not the one that you and I were in, but the one where Bahia came and she taught a class, she actually said to us as students that there are no isolations in belly dancing. I thought I was going to fall over and drop dead because I've been saying this since I discovered the Egyptian dance code, and nobody has been wanting to listen to me. And it's true, there are no isolations. And then there's these snake arms. There are no snake arms in Egyptian dancing. It's all a shoulder movement. And if you bring your arms out, the shoulders are the follow through. And if you watch a lot of the Egyptian dancers, especially Naga Fouad, I think she's left-sided, and her shoulders move, but one of her arms is not as fluid as the other because one is stronger than the other side. So I think Suherazaki is the one that really has practiced on her shoulder movements to bring her arms in so that now she has these little shoulder wrists articulations that look really pretty, but it's in the shoulders. And if you see Fifi Abdo, she does a lot of shoulder movements, but not anything that looks like a snake arm movement. Then there's something that we all know is the three-quarter shimmy. And I love Jamila Salimpour, who brought this dance into San Francisco back in the early 1960s and perhaps 50s. But the way that she teaches it with the three-quarter shimmy, that is the Western experience. But if you use the Egyptian dance code, it puts a whole different slant on it, and all of a sudden you start looking like, you know, Katie, who is one of the dancers in Egypt, or Mona Said, or, you know, Zizi Mustafa. So that's another difference in the movement. I kind of made a list, but I think I'm running out of the list, but just putting in that Egyptian dance code and lifting the rib cage makes a whole difference in your dance.
Great. Those are some really good examples. I'd like to ask a couple of clarifying questions just because I think I know what you mean, but I'm not 100% sure. And if I'm not sure, I'm sure somebody else is wondering too. Okay. So when you were talking about snake arms, it sounded to me like you were saying that instead of thinking about it as moving your hands up and down in space, it's about keeping your hands more or less still, but allowing the action of the shoulder roll to ripple through the arms a little bit so they absorb that motion. Is that what you were talking about?
Yes, that's correct. Sounds about right. But again, the forearms don't really come into play unless you really want them to. It doesn't really need to be in your forearms. If you just roll your shoulders and lift your arms slightly and you get that, what the Egyptians call dala, which is the coquettish part of the dance, that shoulder roll will really come through as real coquettish rather than just moving your upper arm and then your forearm and then the wrist.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. And when you were talking about Maya hips, I think we talked about, you mentioned that you were concerned that some people might not know what you meant. I learned the movement as Maya, so that may be the case. Other people that I know learned it as a reverse vertical figure eight. So if anybody's wondering, that's what we're talking about. Can you tell us a little bit more about how that's done differently in Egyptian dance?
Sure. First of all, in Egyptian dancing, there's no vertical or horizontal or anything like that. It's all three-dimensional. So if you're doing I call that a lower two. I have my own vocabulary because I can't teach using other people's vocabulary because it doesn't ring true. So when I do a lower two, if you're facing the mirror, you would twist your whole body over to your left as you lift your hip, and then you twist your body to the left. You don't lift your hip. Your right hip, you push it out toward the corner of the room, then rotate it back. As you rotate it back, you stand up again, and then you push the left hip over to the left corner of the room and rotate it back, so that you're always having this lift drop in your movement, and the hips are doing a three-dimensional type of move rather than that vertical or horizontal movement that I saw a lot of teachers teach. Can you visualize that?
I think I'm getting there. But although the three dimensionality that you mentioned is really interesting because, so I was trained in an American cabaret context that was very heavily Turkish influenced. That's just my teaching lineage on the East Coast. And one of the big things that I noticed when I switched to a more, not when I switched, when I started cross training with a more Lebanese based teacher was that her approach to the opposite of the Maya, the straight up vertical figure eight, was that it was kind of a back up front down instead of trying to be stuck between two panes of glass and stay absolutely in one plane. Is that similar to what you were describing with the Maya?
Yeah, kind of like that. And I'm glad to know that the Lebanese dancer was teaching you to dance because she's right there in that same area. That's great.
Excellent.
Yeah, that's about the same thing as what I was saying. Yes, not between two panes of glass. No.
Gotcha. All right. And then there was one more movement, and I didn't jot down notes about what it was. What was my question? Ah!
Well, I know I mentioned the three-quarter shimmy.
Yes, thank you.
Okay.
Now, this is one of those places where I think vocabulary might trip up di people from different areas.
Right.
You mentioned Jamila Salimpour, and my understanding is that three-quarter shimmy in that context means different directions of movement. They can mean several different directions of movement, but it usually means a quick, slow pattern. Is that what you meant?
Well, yeah, I have to apologize. I never took a class with Jamila Salimpour, and I only took maybe 1 hour with Suhaila, because I had taken from Jodette, I just couldn't understand what she was talking about. But I guess it means, I don't know what quick, slow means, but if you were to do it with Egyptian dance code, as you lift the rib cage, now because we're using the lower body, as you lift the rib cage and come out with your right foot, the left hip pushes back. And so that once the left hip pushes back and you are now changing your balance to your right foot to do this movement, you come through with pushing out the right hip and then lifting the left hip up and then pushing it back again. And this creates something that's really interesting because when you count this, you count it one, two, and three, four, and one, two, and three, four, and. Of course, one is up, two is down, but you've got that and in there. And when you start playing the finger cymbals, this is the pattern of the finger cymbal. Right, left, one, two, and three, four, and. It's very interesting how that all comes together.
All right. So let's move on to musicality. I think that's a good segue there. Do you
Okay.
find that Egyptian dancers listen for different things in the music than Western dancers do?
Oh, definitely. And the reason why they do is because they were born and brought up over there, and we were born and brought up over here. So we have an ear for Western music. So I don't know about you, but when I first started listening to Arabic music, it was hard on my ear. I was almost incapable of continuing to hear this music because it was just so raw, and I didn't understand how the Egyptians could even understand that music. But the more you hear it, the more you get it, the more you understand it, then you study it, then you find out how many scales there are in the in Arabic music and how many drum beats there are and what their names are and all that. And then you start to study, the musicians and who wrote what and when and where and who danced to it. So the music sounds a little bit more familiar, and it becomes more and more familiar. And then, of course, when I was working here for at the Grape Leaf, when I was married to my husband, I heard it every single day. So I became very familiar with it. But when the West or when Americans hear Arabic music, they may be drawn to it, but they're still going to dance to it basically with a Western mentality because that's our experience. And I have proof positive of that when I was studying this dance. I've got a couple of videos on YouTube about 20 years ago that shows it, and I look at it and I just wonder, what the heck was I thinking? But I put them up there anyway because I wasn't teaching at that time, it's fun to put videos on YouTube. But yes, the Egyptians do hear things very differently. And when you study the Egyptian dance code and how that is applied in the dance, all of a sudden, even the music takes on a different feel and a different way of interpreting it. there is something in the Egyptian music which I find very interesting, and that is when you hear a drum beat, doom doom tack attack, doom tack attack, or something similar to that, a lot of the times the music comes on after the first beat. In other words, doom, and then the music comes. So you have that space of the doom where there's no melody. And I've noticed a lot, especially in classic Egyptian dancers, because that's what I teach, that the classic Egyptian dancers don't start right away on that first beat. They wait until the melody starts, and then they start on probably the third beat, because that's the beat that lifts their rib cage. And this is why also that the Egyptian dancers don't look like they're being rushed all the time. They wait until they hear the melody. And then, of course, you know, you have every single Egyptian dancer that listens to the music and interprets it differently, much like we in the United States listen to music and interpret it differently, but we move to it in an American way. So when you see, something like Lissa Facker being played on YouTube, and you see Suher Zaki, and then you go to Zizi Mustafa, and then maybe you may go and see Fifi Abdo dancing to it, they're going to look completely different. They're not going to look at all alike, but there will be one thing that will be common among all three of them, and that is that they all look like Egyptian dancers dancing classic Egyptian dance.
And what kinds of things should we be listening for in the music to help us bring that quality to our own dancing?
Well, you know, I think the Western dancer really listens very well to the music, and I think sometimes there's too much being danced to. I mean, I think some dancers want to get at least 20 movements into a measure of four, which is totally kind of blows away my mind. But I think we listen really well to dancing. I think if we listen more to what's relevant to us at the time we're listening to it and respond to that, well, it will make a lot more sense. Certainly there are the tacks that come up in music. If music is repeated, you hear this tack, 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 tack. You can pick that up by doing some kind of accent, of course. And then there's the little nuances. You know, for instance, somebody sings a piece of music, a sentence, and then a violin comes in and does something, and then somebody sings again and the violin comes in to end that. Those are called little nuances, and you can respond to that. But overall, I think except for the fact that I think Westerners put too much into their dance, I think we listen really well to it. Maybe that's why we put so much in our dance, because we try to really listen and well to it and try to put as much as we can into it to show our audience that we know the music.
I'm trying to think of who said it, but I remember it was a fashion quote that was, "Elegance is refusal," right? It's about what you don't do as much as what you do.
Right. Yeah, well, you know, Chanel, I love Chanel because she was the, in my opinion, the epitome of fashion. She was very simple, but boy, did she make a statement. Mm-hmm.
All right. Now, we've been talking about, listening for differences in the music. We've been talking about differences in execution. But, one of the big things that we are all taught over and over again is that the feeling is the most important part of the dance. Do you find that what feeling the music means is different for Egyptian dancers versus Western dancers?
Well, when I first got the sentence from, an Arab or, person that was frequenting my restaurant saying, "You have to feel the music." I kept thinking to myself, what the heck does that mean? What does feel the music mean? I'm feeling the music. I'm feeling the music all over the place. Can't you see that? And of course, I think the reason why he's saying that is because, of course, I'm an American and I was feeling the music the way a Westerner or the way I would feel the music as I had been brought up in a Western culture. And so I devised this little tool that seems to work really well. And that is that if you're dancing to a piece of music, and of course now, you know, everybody has to know the words to the piece of music, where when I started, we didn't even know the name of the music, much less the words. But if you don't know the words, or if you don't, if you are having trouble connecting with the audience while you're dancing, and and you're dancing to a piece of music that somebody just popped in and said, you know, let's see you dance or whatever. If you hear the canoon, which is plucked, or if you hear the oud, which is also plucked, you know automatically that's going to be some kind of a shimmy. If you hear a violin that is played fluidly and not plucked, or if you hear the keyboard, you know, playing something that's fluid, that's going to be some kind of an undulation of sorts. If you hear that the music is high, for instance, a flute, you know that the movement is going to be high in your head. It could be low in your body, but you have to think high in your head and maybe get on your toes. If you hear the music low, then of course it's going to be lower in the body. If a movement is low in the body, it usually, and not always, because there's always one instance, it usually means that you can put a frown on your face and smile. In other words, it hurts so good. And without looking, you know, without looking, of course, like it's soft porn, that's something else that I don't care to see. But you know what I mean? I'm sorry. But if you have that look in your face as if it hurts so good and you're still playing with an audience, it really does respond to the Arab community, and it does perk up the audience a lot better. If you're doing some kind of a shoulder shimmy, which I know a lot of dancers don't do so much now these days because it's kind of frowned upon. And by the way, Naga Fuad and Zinat Elwi loved shoulder shimmies, and I think Katie did a few. If you do shoulder shimmies and you're doing them within the different dance code, it looks like fun. It doesn't look like, you know, like you're getting down. And if you do that, then of course you smile with a big smile. And I think Taya Carioca was smiling a lot when she was dancing. But then, of course, she had asthma, and the reason why she was smiling was because, and opening her mouth was because she was trying to catch a breath. But all the dancers that saw her emulated her, and they started to do that as well in the movies.
Mm-hmm. All right. Now, when you and I were talking about, you know, some of the things that we might like to cover in this interview, you mentioned the idea of the rule of four. Can you tell us a little bit more about what that means and how we can use it?
Sure. If you listen to a piece of music, and I'm kind of talking about performance music. If you're listening to performance music and you're listening through it once to try to find out what you're going to do to it, and by the way, I think Egyptian dancers do have a sense of having choreographed a piece of music, because once you listen to it 10 times, you kind of know what you're going to do, so you're going to have some kind of choreography to it, and it may be somewhat improvised, but it's according to how you've choreographed it in your mind. Oh my gosh, I lost my train of thought. Oh, rule of four. Okay. You'll notice that in some of that music, and not always throughout the music, but there's some places that melodies are repeated four times. And normally when they're repeated four times, the first and the third are similar to the second and the fourth times. The second and the fourth times are usually with more instrumentation. So with more instrumentation, what I do or what I tell my students to do is, you know, travel in there. If it's subdued and has one instrument, you stay in place and dance according to that instrument. If it's a violin, then it's all kind of undulations. And if it's a canoon or an oud plucked, then it's with a shimmy. So that's one instance. There's another instance where there's something that I've labeled a bridge. A bridge is four measures of four counts that are repeated four times that connects one melody to another. And sometimes it's the drum section that follows the leader that will announce you and will be the gateway to coming out to do your performance. And there's usually four of those, and the third one usually is a little different than the fourth one, usually sums the whole thing up. So if you listen to a piece of music, if you can pick out where the sequences of 4R in any one section, then it's really easy to follow this rule and dance according to, you know, that tool that I just talked about.
Excellent.
Okay. I'm sure you can probably think of some performance pieces that have that in them. Most performance pieces, pieces that are written, you know, for the stage or have been rewritten for the stage from, you know, the pieces that have vocals in them, have this. I'm sure you have noticed this.
Sure. All mm-hmm. right. You know, one thing I'd like to talk about as well is, you know, this evolution of Egyptian dance. You know, the words classical Egyptian or golden age and modern Egyptian get thrown around a lot. And it seems like most people who are saying these things, you know, agree that some dancers definitely fall into one versus the other, but there's a lot of disagreement about where one stops and the other begins. So when you're talking about classical Egyptian or the more modern era, when would you personally define that transition?
Well, I did an article for Gilded Serpent for Lynette. She's the one that she's the editor of Gilded Serpent, and there was a National Geographic video that came out back in 1992, and they featured Lucy. Lucy is a dancer that came after Fifi Abdul, and it was, in my opinion, and Lucy's beautiful and everything like that. But in my opinion, I think that National Geographic did not do their homework, and I think they should have gone for Fifi Abdul. Lucy, through that National Geographic video or documentary, which was kind of short, basically is a dividing line to classic and modern. I think Lucy, because her style is somewhat more subdued and not so flamboyant as Fifi Abdul, I think she basically set the tone for a more modern look. And of course, you know, that National Geographic was aired here in 1992. I remember I saw it. I didn't even know who Fifi Abdul was at that time. And I thought, oh my gosh, look at that. Lucy's dancing. And I don't even know who Lucy is. And boy, she looks great. And then as I studied more of the dance, I realized how at that point that changed. And then Dina came on board and changed it more. Fifi Abdul is the end of the classic era. It went from Taher Carioca through Fifi Abdul. Then from Fifi Abdul, at the end around Fifi Abdul, when Lucy comes in through Dina and then Randa and everybody else, that to me is the start of the more modern style. And more of the shabby comes out there with Dina and her costumes. So that to me is the dividing line.
Mm-hmm. And do you have any sense of what caused that change? Was it just, you know, simple evolution, or was there anything that, you know, sparked a sudden aesthetic change?
I think it was when National Geographic came out and had Lucy on TV, you know, it was in a lot of people's homes, and a lot of people who saw Lucy wanted to take belly dancing classes. And here in the United States, the explosion was around about that time. I think dance evolves no matter what. I mean, if you look at Taher Carioca and then Sammy Gamal and Soher Zaki and Nagel Fouad, it's evolving all the time. As a matter of fact, mm-hmm. Nagel Fouad basically was the one who did the big hip circle so that, you know, it goes around to the back. Before Nagel Fouad, that wasn't there. What I'm saying is that after Fifi Abdul, something changed, and it became more balletic, a more subdued look, a more balletic style, a more, the guts was taken out of the dance. I don't know how else to explain it, but that's what I feel what happened to it.
Mm-hmm. And what would you describe as some of the distinguishing characteristics of each era? You know, are there some things that you see more in classical versus modern?
Yes, in classical, I see more shoulder shimmies. I see more arms. There's a lot more arms. There's no ballet stuff happening. I see more fluidity. There's not so much lip syncing. And by the way, you know, I was talking to Jodette the last time I was there, and she's doing really well. I asked her about this lip syncing thing, and she said, "Oh my God, this is something that just happened recently. This never happened when I was teaching." So that's something else that's happened in the modern era, is this lip syncing stuff. I think the fluidity has kind of changed since, you know, in the modern era, and the flamboyance has changed. I know that a lot of people say that Egyptian dancing, just classic Egyptian style dancing, is more subtle. There's nothing subtle about Fifi Abdo. There's nothing subtle about Naga Fouad. There is nothing subtle about Soher Zaki. But, you know, there's just nothing subtle. I think it became a little bit more subtle after Lucy and Dina, who changed the costuming, and she changed the way the dance was, and she did a lot more walking. So those are the changes I see.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, does the Egyptian dance code play out in the same ways in both styles, or has that, how the way that gets applied morphed with the music as well?
Oh no, it's still all there. The Egyptian dance code's never going to go, because it's part of the Egyptian cultural experience. It's there. It's stuck. We just have to know how to find it and what to see to be able to see how it's working. But it's there. It's going to be there forever. I truly believe this. Even if some of the dancers come to the United States and see what we're doing, they're going to take it back, and they're going to apply what they learned from us with the Egyptian dance code. I've seen that. It's part of their experience. It's like, I don't know. It's like, I can't describe what it's like, but it's their experience.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. And, you know, we've been focusing mostly on Egyptian dance. We touched a little bit on Lebanese and some other styles. Do you find that the Egyptian dance code plays out in the same ways in other non-Western styles of belly dance? Or is it completely different for each style?
You mean belly dancing, like in other countries, like now Korea and Japan and
places
like that?
I was thinking more like Lebanon and Turkey, where you do get distinct regional styles. They're not Western, but they're also not Egyptian.
Right, right. Well, again, you know, there's a it's still the Middle East, and it's still thought of as Arabic countries. Lebanon is pretty, has a lot of influence with France. You know, they've got a lot of French that come over there, and I think their second language, or one of their languages, is French. But they still are from that part of the world where it is inclusive of the Middle East. And then in Turkey, I haven't really been watching the Turkish style per se, although I think Didim is Turkish. It's a little bit less visible in those two countries, but you know, it was all the Ottoman Empire at one point, and who's to say that the Egyptians, having been under the Ottoman Empire, didn't teach the Turks and the Lebanese to dance? I mean, they're all part of the the Ottoman Empire, we really found out more about this dance. Not from wall coverings, but we learned it more from the movies, from the Egyptian film industry. So we see the dancing from the Egyptian film industry in the movies, where in Lebanon there isn't that big a film industry, and the films that were filmed in Lebanon had the dancers that were working in Egypt and then flew to Lebanon as well and danced in those places before, you know, the war. So they were part, the Egyptian dancers were part of the film industry there. And I haven't seen any belly dancing really come out of Turkey per se. Most of the stuff that we see really comes out of the Egyptian film industry.
All right. Well, it sounds like a really interesting experiment to do sometime. Would be to really learn how to see it, to see all of these things that you're describing in an Egyptian dance context, and then, go off and I'll spend a couple hours on YouTube, look at Turkish and
Oh,
Lebanese
no.
dancers and see if I can see it. But it definitely sounds like starting just with learning to see it in an Egyptian context is the way to go.
Well, once you see it, you can identify it in every single dancer who is dancing in Egypt, who's an Egyptian style dancer or an Arabic dancer. You can see it, but at this point, when we don't have it in our experience to see, we only see the dancers dancing, and then we ask ourselves, and I used to ask myself, how come I don't look like that? How come my arms don't move that way? What am I doing wrong? And I remember standing in front of the mirror trying to emulate those dancers, and it didn't look right. And I had a video of my teacher, Dodette, and I found it. Unfortunately, I have to get another copy because I think it's kind of walked away, but I found it and I put it in just to see, what my teacher looked like back when, and it was right there staring me right in the face, that Egyptian dance code where she's dancing and she's lifting her rib cage. It's very subtle. You can barely see it. You can see it really well on Fifi Abdul. She is the quintessential person to watch when you're watching the Egyptian dance code. Once you see it in Fifi Abdul, and if you look carefully, you're going to see it in Nagafouad, you're going to see it in Katie, Seherzaki, all the unknowns like Samiha Tawfiq. Just it's there. It's uncanny.
Excellent. Well, we're going to open up the call to questions and answers in just a minute. So, folks who are listening, start thinking about what it is that you might like to ask. But before we do that, if people take one thing away from this call, if they really, internalize one thing, what would you want that to be?
That would be for to if you're studying a dance from a country, and this and we're talking about belly dancing and right now Egyptian style, that is to study it, with respect and revere it because it's the country's cultural expression. It is their way of thinking, their way of doing, their way of talking, which is, all comes into the dance. And if you want to take it a step further, study a little bit about the language, because in the Arabic language, there's only three long vowels. We have basically five vowels. They have three long vowels and three short vowels, and then they have all of these different other things that happen around how they speak. And when they write, it's all kind of calligraphy like, and our letters are kind made with strokes that are up and down and square. All of this translates into the dance, and if you study the language, you will understand why the dance is danced the way it is, just studying the language. It's amazing. And how they speak and how they express themselves. And so, if you can study the language, that would be really great. You'll see the accent of the Egyptian, dance rather than putting an American accent on into the belly dancing. That's what I would like to have people carry away with this.
And if people want to learn more from you, how can they do that?
Oh gosh, I appreciate this. Of course, they can always, go onto my website at sousanacademy.com, and I have ongoing classes. I don't have drop-ins. I teach primary, secondary, tertiary, and then applied basic principal courses, which is all inclusive. And by the end of the 1 year, theoretically and conceptually, you'll know how to move. Your body may not be strong enough to move, but you'll know how to, so that if you want to continue the studies, we learn music and then move with the music. In studying these Egyptian dancers, I've studied them dancing in the movies when they were young, all the way up until they get to be older dancers. And they learn exactly like we do. They have the Egyptian dance code and we don't, but they learn exactly like we do. They are stiff in the beginning, and by the time they reach a certain age, they are as fluid as we turn out to be when we've been studying that long. So, we all study the same way. let's see, there's also, I also have a 7-day intensive seminar, of course, coming up. And if you don't mind, I can talk to you about, talk to you.
Please do.
Listeners about it. Okay. It's coming up in September the 5th for a week. And we talk about all of the stuff that we talked about today. I show video. I teach my whole entire year in the 7 days. And if you're listening today and you want to sign up, you can sign up and I'll even take $50 off your registration fee just by mentioning that you were on this program.
Awesome. And how should people do that? Do they email you or?
They can email me or they can call me and I can give you my number if that's all right.
Please do.
Okay. The number is my cell. It's 415-867-6754. And my email address is SousonAcademy.
And that's all in San Francisco.
Oh, I'm sorry. That's in San Francisco.
I'm sorry. You patched out for a second. Would you say that again?
Okay. Sure. The telephone number, is that what I need to repeat, my telephone number?
No, I was just asking you to confirm that those events are happening in San Francisco.
Yes, they're happening in San Francisco, and it's all happening here in my restaurant. And if you do sign up, it does include all breakfast, continental breakfast, lunch, and then 4 nights of dinner. And then on the Sunday, the last day, the music that we study on the last day, you are welcome to perform it in the restaurant as part of the graduation.
Ooh, that sounds like a great way to cap that off. Now, for folks who can't get out to California, are you open to taking your show on the road?
Most definitely. I am available. And anybody that wants to call me and do that, I do have courses in introductions to the Egyptian dance code, and I also teach a really great drum solo class and also movement on arms according to the Egyptian dance code. Yes, I will take it on the road.
Awesome. All right. Well, I think it is time to start taking some questions from our listeners. So those of you who are just listening on the webcast, our computer audio in place, there is a little questions box that you can type into on the left. So if you look at on the right, if you look at the right-hand side of your screen, there's a little button with a speech bubble, and that will expand it. You can type in your questions, and I'll read those out on the air. But if you are listening by phone or Skype, you can press ** to unmute yourself. So that's ** on your phone or ** on your Skype keypad if you're calling in by Skype. We would love to hear your questions. Or if you don't have a question, I'd also love to hear what your favorite thing is that you picked up from this call. So your favorite learning, your favorite tidbit, any of that would be awesome. So come say hello.
Is there a question coming up?
I'm waiting. You know, I think sometimes there's a delay of a few seconds before folks hear me. And also people tend to be shy about being the first person to ask a question. So if somebody wants to be the brave one.
Is there a chance I can say one more thing before the question comes up?
Absolutely.
Okay. Well, you know, on June 6, 2001, on BBC News, Suhair Zaki wrote a statement, or she said something, and she said, "They," meaning the West, "they will never be up to Egyptian standards, the Egyptian belly dance standards." She says, "They don't have the lively spirit, they don't have the sense of humor, and they don't have the musical ear." Then she says, they only perform steps that they learn, 1, 2, 3, 4, but they don't have the spirit. They will never, ever match us. You know what? Yes, they can. Yes, we will, because the Egyptian dance code is the key. And I've proven it more times than I can say. So Suhair Zaki, I love you to death, but watch out.
All right. So Orit says, "I just wanted to say hi to Sousin. I came in late, but this was great."
Oh, wonderful. Well, hi back to Orit. She did take a class that I was giving out complimentary to kind of sort of show people what I was meaning about the Egyptian dance code, and she took it, and she thought, I mean, I was so blessed by having her take my little class there, and say hi back to her. I love her to death.
Awesome. All right. If anybody else would like to ask a question, if you need something clarified, or we've got some follow-ups, or if you want to share your favorite thing that you learned, we would love to hear from you. You can press star to unmute yourself.
Well, I'm hoping to hear from somebody.
All right. It looks like we've got somebody possibly in New York. Hi there.
Yes, that's me. Hi, Salvin, it's me, Lavana.
Oh, hi, how are you? I'm so glad you were able to make the show.
Oh, me too. Thank you so much. Shukran. And
Afwan.
so anyway, what I discovered that I really need to learn more is when you were talking about the analysis of the composition of the music and the sequences and stuff like that. It's I understand with a kanun, you know, lud, oud, oud, you do shimmies and things like that, and you know, with a more lyrical, the nai and the keyboard, you have more fluid moves. That I already knew, but you were speaking more in depth about the composition of sequences, or I can't remember the words that you used.
Yes.
That's where that was a lot for me to swallow. That I couldn't quite follow you exactly. You said it beats one and three and two and four, you know, but in the course of the sequence of the music. And anyway, so that's what I would like to, you know, have a little bit more clarified, if at all possible.
Of course. And I did teach a class on this at the Las Vegas Belly Dance Intensive. It was called Dissecting Music for Dancing. And there are several entities in the music that I've been able to pick out for performance music, which constantly come up. And one of them is called the bridge, which I explain. And there are regular bridges, and then there are irregular bridges. And I bring those up. We have one whole entire class on bridges. We have one whole entire class on when you can hear something called call and response. When you hear something called call and response in the music,
Yes.
that's your opportunity to do something and then turn, do something else and then turn, do something else and then turn. And of course,
Samson, I
these
think we
are
might
just.
have lost you for just a second.
Oh, okay. So
Yep, the last thing I
when.
think I heard is when you hear call and response in the music.
Right. That's when you can take that and use it as there's like two portions to the call and response. There's the call and then there's the response. When you hear one portion, you could turn. You hear the response, you can do the shimmy, you can do shoulders, whatever the music is telling you to do. When you hear that call again, turn the other way and then do something else. So this is another entity. And of course, these are just tools. They're not hard. They're not, yeah. Then, of course, there's something which I call the soliloquy. Now, in my classes, the soliloquy are what you know of as taxium. And it's interesting about the word taxium. Taxium comes from, it means improvise, right? So I
I
use the
didn't
word
know.
so. I'm sorry?
I didn't know. I thought taxi meant cut or divide, sort of an interlude or something, but it's a solo instrument and it seems to be usually less rhythmical in the structured sense. It's that's
That's
where you do
correct.
improvise.
Right. It's to the musicians, they call it taxium, and it means improv or improvise. With the music, I mean, you have to improvise no matter what because you're dancing. But with the music, they're just kind of improvising. Sometimes it's the flute, sometimes it's the violin. But in my experience and my study of this certain entity of music, there are three, and I call this soliloquy because when you're doing something, it cannot be choreographed. You have to interpret the music and dance it according to how you hear the music and how it's being played. And in my study of it, there are three kinds of soliloquies or three kinds of taxiums, and two of them may or may not have beats behind them. And one of them has that drone sound in the background. And we study that as entities as well. So my tertiary class is a study on the dissection of music, and once the gals go through that, and it's very cerebral, once they go through that, they have a better understanding of the music.
That's cool.
Yeah, thank
Yeah.
you.
Thank you.
Yes, I just want to end by saying one thing. This is very enlightening. I used to volunteer at a cancer center for New Year's Eve and dance for them. And, you know, the patients were there in their masks and their tubes and, you know, their medication, and they're wearing gowns and, they, you know, and kerchiefs on their heads, you know. They were going having chemotherapy.
Oh, so I was
doing my dance, and then, you know, and I just noticed, you know, there were times when the audience was clapping, meaning they, and twice this happened, I noticed across the room, I said to myself, and I thought of you, I bet that girl is from the Middle East. And then twice that happened, I walked up to them. Oh, where are you from? I'm from Turkey. I don't remember the exact countries, but I knew what you were talking about, even though I couldn't explain it. There was just something in their body, the way they moved. Like you know, when somebody comes to America from a foreign country and they have an accent and you know they're not American, you know they're from somewhere else. I picked that up right away, that they were Middle Eastern or Arabic, and I was right. And it was because of you that I noticed
And then
one more thing. When I was studying belly dancing, and I went to one of the recitals, and the girls were young and pretty and gorgeous, you know, and skinny and all the traits I wished I had. But the way they were dancing, even though they had a memory for elephants, like for choreography, the way they moved, I said, gee, they look like very American. And this was before Thousand, before I knew you. I knew there was something, and I said it to myself. So
yes.
when you were talking about there's just something, the way they moved, like they were speaking American English or something.
Yes, correct.
And so when you were talking about this in the emails and the Yahoo groups when I first met you online, wow, did I connect with you? There was just something, and I was just hungry to learn. Thank you very much for reiterating some of my thoughts.
Thank you so much for coming on.
Oh, sure. Okay, thank you. Okay.
All right. Thanks for calling in. All right. If there's anybody else who'd like to ask a question or share their tidbit, I would love to hear it. You can press ** to unmute yourself.
There's one more thing I would like to say. There's always going to be one more thing, but this will be the one more last thing.
Sure.
The thing that makes dance the way it is in a passionate sense is how it's from the experience of how they live their lives in that country. And you know, for flamenco dance is called duende. It's called tener duende, which means they have the spirit or the soul of the dance. And in Thai classical dance, and I'm using these two examples because these were my first two ethnic styles that I danced, the dance is derived from the practices of Buddhism. So there's a lot of that goes into the Thai classical dancing. And when I watch belly dancing, the classic Egyptian style, and when I teach it, I have coined a term called nephis, and nephis is the it of it. It's the soul and the spirit. It's the essence of the dance. And I know we call it having it. Oh, she's got it. She looks great. She's got it. I don't know what it is, but she's got it. I call it nephis. Nephis is not even a word in the English language. It's an old word, but nephis means the soul. So while flamenco has duende, we have nephis.
You know, in Turkish, nefis, which is probably a loan word, means breath.
I wonder if that
might be related.
It is related.
Awesome.
It is. Yes.
Awesome.
Okay.
Well, thank you so much, Susan.
Well, I so appreciate this fabulous opportunity, and thank you so much for inviting me into, you know, basically your home to speak about this. It's something I've been talking about since the year 2000, and I've been putting it out there, and I haven't had too many favorable responses, but I know that I'm getting more and more. It's just a huge revelation when I discovered this, and I just wanted to tell the whole world about it, and I just realize now knowing what I know, that maybe if I was a little bit quieter, I would have had better open arms, but I know there was a big controversy a while back when I started talking about it. So I really appreciate this opportunity that you gave me to be able to talk about it on your show. Thank you.
My pleasure. You know what? And it looks like we did miss another comment in that was typed in. So sorry about that. We have a quick comment from Joy who says, I found the part about music and the beat emphasis. It was something I'd noticed too, but Sausen clarified it quite well. Thank you.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate that. Thank you.
Awesome. Thanks, Joy. All right. And if folks don't remember Joy, she's actually a past Clubhouse guest. She and attorney Valerie Lovely were on in my first year of the show to talk about copyright for dancers. So if anybody wants to hear more from Joy, check her out in our archives. All right. Well, thank you, everybody, for coming. This is the end of our call, but that doesn't mean that the conversation has to end. We've got a private Facebook group just for Clubhouse members. That is a private group, so you do have to request to join. That's just how I make sure that we limit it to, you know, actually dancers and not creepy people. So I'll send out a link shortly with an invitation to that group. There will be an approval delay since I do have to check you out and make sure you're a real dancer, but you should be added within a day or two of requesting. In my email, I'll also include a link to the call recording. So if anybody wants to listen again, you can do that, as well as a link to Sausen's website. So if you want to check out her upcoming events, you can do that there. My email also has a link to our feedback survey. So if you have any topics or speakers or that you'd like to hear from or any way that I can improve the Clubhouse, I would love to hear about it. And just to let you know a little bit about what's going on in the belly dance geek world, I am going to be teaching at Cabaret Dance Camp in Texas. That's happening this October 6th through 9th. I'm going to be teaching improvisation skills. So if you would like to sign up, you can do that at cabaretdancecamp.com. And if you do that, please enter code NadiraJamal2016. That way they'll give me credit for your registration, which would be awesome. And I hope I can see you there. I know I've got a Texas ladies that I'm really excited to see again. But my understanding is that people come from all over the U.S. and sometimes outside the U.S. to this event. So we're going to go swimming, we're going to go hiking, and we're going to do lots of dancing. And I am super excited. Our next call is not on the schedule yet. I was hoping to have the date ready for today, but I don't. That will be coming up in August, and I am super excited about this topic. I think this is going to be a really exciting one, so I'm not going to say too much about that just yet, but please do chime in. And the last thing that I want to say is that the Dance Geek Clubhouse is the come on in kind of clubhouse, not the no boys allowed kind. So if you know anybody who'd like to join us, please invite them to do so. You can do that at bellydancegeek.com/clubhouse. And until next time, happy dancing. Good night, everybody.
Good night.
Thanks for listening. For more geektacular resources, check out bellydancegeek.com.